Good afternoon. Our next case on the panel is White versus White. White versus White.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I am Perry Persh on behalf of the defendants and appellants, the brothers White, who are the co-personal representatives of the estate of their deceased father, Leonard White. This matter is over whether or not they, as the beneficiaries of the estate and of a trust, are the rightful owners of a $100,000 cash in dispute and the trailer. I was first before the court here about 25 years ago when I was a senior certified law student on behalf of the Attorney General's office, and I haven't been back by then. But around that time, I had been in Professor Lenich's civil procedure class, and I remember him to this day saying that equity aids the vigilant, not those who slumber on their rights. I think that the legislature had that in mind when they drafted the non-claim statute, which is 30-2485. And in fact, it's a bit draconian, but it requires that all claims against a decedent's estate be brought forward in 2 months in the case of notice and 4 months total. And it's an absolute bar. Now, during the period under the non-claim statute, there are two ways to effectively bring forward a claim. One is to file it with the probate court clerk as a claim on the estate. And the second is to file a suit in a court of competent jurisdiction. But the Supreme Court has stated in the estate of Karzamazin, 299 Nebraska 315, that a court cannot extend the time for filing a claim that arose after death. Furthermore, more recently, in a estate of Lakin, 310 Nebraska 271, the court has reminded us the non-claim statute as a bar is more rigorously applied than the general statute of limitations. And in Nebraska, an administrator cannot waive the defense of non-claim to the prejudice of the estate. The non-claim statute is mandatory, and where a claim is not filed within the time provided by the statute, it is forever barred. That's State of Manipus, 232 Nebraska 936.
Mr. Persh, what was the effect of your clients filing the premarital agreement with the probate court?
I believe it was irrelevant insofar as it would apply as a claim against the estate.
Well, what was its purpose?
It is unclear, Your Honor. To be candid with you, I was not counsel for the defendants at that time. And in the course of discovery, it never came out what the purpose was of the probate attorney at that time. And we are left to speculate.
Isn't it required of a personal representative to make full disclosure of all facts within his or her knowledge that are material to the beneficiaries so that they can protect their interests? And in this case, wasn't Yvonne a beneficiary?
Well, she was not a beneficiary under the will or trust. She had an agreement, a premarital agreement, by which she would receive $100,000 upon the death of the decedent. This was not a testamentary document.
Didn't the prenup actually say that this provision regarding the $100,000 shall be treated as a contract to make a will?
Yes, or at least I wouldn't dispute that. But I don't know that that's relevant.
What's the effect of that language?
Well, clearly she had a claim, a valid claim against the estate. clearly the personal representatives were even aware of it.
Do beneficiaries have to make claims to receive the distribution they're otherwise entitled to under the terms of a will?
A beneficiary would not, but she was not a beneficiary. Nor was it ever argued below that she was a beneficiary of a testamentary document.
Okay, then to go back to Judge Reedman's question, what is the point of putting that language in the prenuptial agreement?
I don't know, but it was an agreement. It did not have the formalities of a will. And perhaps you could say, as the district court did say, that it was a... a judicial admission, but it was not a judicial admission in the case filed by the plaintiff in this case, because a judicial admission is different in a pleading in one case and is merely an admission in another case.
Well,
that's Cook v. Bierman, 202 Nebraska 447.
Well, I think what the court said is the filing of that document in the probate court was an admission. The question is, what is the effect of the language in the prenuptial agreement that this is to be construed as a contract to make a will?
Again, I would argue that it is, for purposes of the case law in Nebraska under the non-claim statute, irrelevant. The opposing counsel was given notice of the deadline to file a claim under the non-claim statute. By definition, the premarital agreement is a premarital agreement. And regardless of whether or not it contains the language that it was considered a contract to make a will, it does not make her a beneficiary under the case law, and it does not have the formalities to be a testamentary document under the statute.
In filing the prenuptial agreement with the probate court, it alerted the court, or kind of paved the way for your clients to be appointed co-personal representatives, correct?
Correct, that and the fact that they were actually nominated under the will, which gave them preference.
And precluded Yvonne from recovering what she would otherwise recover as a spouse, correct?
That was the purpose of the prenuptial agreement.
And the purpose of filing it in the probate court.
I don't think that the prenuptial agreement needed to be filed in the probate court necessarily to preclude Yvonne. I don't know why she filed it. I don't think
she
that it had
didn't
to be
file
filed.
It. Your clients filed it, didn't
why,
they?
When I say she, forgive me, I don't know why the probate attorney filed it on behalf of the estate at the time that she did.
So regardless of the intent, the effect was Yvonne was precluded from recovering what she otherwise would recover as a spouse. Is that correct?
I don't believe that...
Would she have had an elective share?
Whether or not she chose to file under the elective share within 9 months of date of death would be up to her. It's true that under the law she would have the right to file an elective share. It's true that under the premarital agreement she had the right to assert a contractual right to the money. But regardless, she would have to do it under the provisions of the non-claim statute. It's not automatic. It takes an affirmative act on her part, regardless of whether or not it is an election on the spousal share or an election under a contract.
I guess my question is, when we're speculating about the reason for filing or attaching the premarital agreement, would it not also be possible that it was to preclude the elective share process?
It might be, but the burden was on the plaintiff, and the plaintiff never met the burden. A judicial admission has to be clear as far as the intent, and there is no clear intent. for why it was done when the district court judge granted summary judgment on the issue in favor of the plaintiff in this matter. And for that reason, I think that the decision should be reversed. And I see that I'm almost out of time. Are there any further questions?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Bryn Kuhn of Bryn Kuhn Law, on behalf of Yvonne White, the appellee in this case. As the court is aware, this case involves a prenuptial agreement that was executed between a husband and a wife prior to their marriage. In this case, Yvonne White, and I represent the wife in this case. And that prenuptial agreement set forth certain rights and obligations between the parties. In that premarital agreement, the premarital agreement provided that Ms. White, as a spouse, was going to be waiving rights that she had under the law in return for a contractual payment of $100,000. And ultimately, the court found that Ms. White was entitled to that payment by virtue of the premarital agreement. In this case, one of the issues that was raised was that Ms. White did not file a claim against the estate within the 60-day time period. Had she been deemed a beneficiary of the, by virtue of the language of the document, it would not have been necessary for her to file a claim. But in this particular case, something very unusual happened, something that you don't find in your typical probate filing. And that is, in this case, the probate attorney on behalf of the estate and on behalf of the two personal representatives filed the premarital agreement. And within the document that they filed for purposes of probate, they went on further to say that this is a true and correct copy of the document executed by the parties, and to further say that that document had been unrevoked and was still in full force and effect as of the time of Mr. White's death. And that has legal significance when they come in there and they attach this that they're not required to do. They're putting Ms. White on notice that we recognize that there's a claim here that you have in the estate, and that claim is defined by this particular document. There wasn't anything left to ambiguity. There wasn't anything to be determined based on a percentage of the augmented estate or anything of that nature. It was spelled out completely in that premarital agreement.
So if it had not been attached, would Yvonne have had to file a claim?
If she was not determined to be a beneficiary of the estate, yes, then she would have been required to file a claim.
And on what basis would you argue she should have been determined a beneficiary?
Just what the court raised earlier today, the fact that the language in and of itself within the premarital agreement says that this will essentially be a contract for a will.
Was that raised at the trial court level?
It was not. But it is it is an issue in this case with regard to the outcome of this case as to how the court views the contractual agreement between the party, and that's what this case all boils down to, is what was agreed to between the parties as far as what Mrs. White was supposed to receive and as part of her claim as a spouse to Mr. White after his passing.
Are you, it's putting you on the spot a little bit here, but are you aware of any authority that addresses this specific language and what it means in terms of making somebody a beneficiary versus a claimant?
I am on the spot, and no, I cannot specifically cite a case to you at this very moment.
What,
with
you don't have that,
that
just back in the back of your head? Okay.
I've been doing this for 33 years, but I have not run across that particular case.
The language being, this document shall be construed as a contract to make a will.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So I'll ask you the same questions. The effect of filing that document with the probate court precluded Yvonne from collecting what she may otherwise have collected as a spouse.
Correct. It's specifically spelled out in the premarital agreement that she's waiving rights that she normally would have as a spouse in return for this specific payment. I mean, it's very clear with regard to that issue.
So here's the rub. Our case law is pretty clear that the claimant needs to file a claim. And it's not sufficient for the personal representatives to be aware of the claim but rather there actually has to be a filing by the claimant.
And I understand that there is that statute that requires that. However, I would argue that a claim was made in this particular case, and that claim was filed during the claim period, the amount of the claim, and the document for which it arises, because it was filed because it affected both Leonard White and what obligations he had in the estate, as well as what Yvonne White had as a spouse upon his death. And specifically, it addressed all of those issues in terms of the amount of the claim. They were put on notice by virtue of the fact that they knew that the claim that existed. This isn't like the Lakin case that has been cited, where the attorneys had some discussion, a letter may have gone back and forth about a potential claim. They specifically attached this document saying, we know about this claim, and this claim is valid, and essentially they waived any opportunity to say that it's not a valid claim. If they would not have attached the document and said what they said within their pleading, they could have come in and said they revoked it, or that it was unconscionable for some reason at the time that it was executed, or come up with some other reason to deny the claim, but they didn't do that. They specifically put that language in there that it was a valid and existing claim.
Yeah, but doesn't the fact that they're acknowledging that there's this prenup and there may be these obligations, the fact that they have notice, that they're on notice and they're letting everybody know, we know, does that discharge the requirement under the statute that the claimant must file the claim? And I don't know how you get around Gaventer, Lincoln, Pureholm. They all say notice and awareness of a potential claim is not enough.
But, and again, I would argue that there's a bit of a difference. Notice of the claim, that there's this potential claim out there, or a letter, or something informal. But when you go in a pleading, and you attach the document, and then you state the language that this was unrevoked, and it's very clear this is an obligation that we owe, I mean, it serves the purpose of the claim, and it is filed during the claim period. I mean, it puts the other person on, you know, on the notice of from the standpoint of they already know about the claim. They're already validating the claim. They're already saying that the claim exists. What else is there with regard to the claim?
A person needs to demand payment of the claim.
Okay, and I get that. That's certainly an issue in this case, mm-hmm. As far as that's concerned. So, with regard to the $100,000, I mean that's ultimately what the issue boils down to is. One, are they a beneficiary? That's number one, versus a claimant. And if a claimant, does this arise to the level of a claim, even though Yvonne White did not file it herself and make a demand that claim be paid?
So you could write our opinion for us right there.
There you go. And then lastly, we have the issue of a camper that was involved in this case. And if you look at the premarital agreement provides that anything that was acquired after the marriage in the way of personal property, and this is personal property, a fifth-wheel camper is not real estate, under those circumstances, it's then joint tenancy property. I mean, that's what the document itself says.
But he specifically titled it in his name only and interestingly used his son's address. The title.
And that may very well be, but the document, I believe, between the parties that was executed before, I think, governs over a title document that just says, you know, it's titled in my name. Keep in mind that there's lots of personal property that can be titled through a bill of sale or some other document, but if it's governed by the premarital agreement, I think the premarital agreement overrides that in terms of as it relates to these two parties.
But doesn't the agreement provide that if you're using your premarital separate funds to purchase something after the marriage, it remains outside the marriage?
I'm not aware of that. I didn't see a paragraph in there that said if premarital funds is being used to purchase this item, well, then it doesn't fall within that. It doesn't say that in 2.2b, I believe it is, of the premarital agreement.
And in fact, personal property is actually defined to include motor vehicles, boats, and sports equipment.
It does say right? That, but this is, remember, a fifth-wheel camper, so it doesn't have an engine.
Doesn't quite fit.
It falls in between a recreational vehicle like a boat and a motor vehicle which has an engine in it. So but it says by way of example. So right. It's not limiting it to those right. categories of items. Does the court have any other questions?
Does it have any bearing that he, I mean, the evidence seems to reflect that he borrowed, took some money from his equity line tied to his premarital property to pay the difference between the trade-in, which I don't think it's disputed the trade-in was premarital property.
No, right? Not disputed. If he would have used purchase money, and as that purchase money, there would have been a lien against that vehicle through a purchase money security interest of some kind, she would have taken that fifth wheel subject to whatever debt, just like any other estate proceeding, where if you take an asset that has a lien on it, that is subject to the lien. But in this particular case, he chose to pay that debt through some other source, not through the item that was purchased. And so therefore, it's our position that there's nothing that we're obligated, or that my client is obligated for with respect to that vehicle, because he chose to finance it that way as opposed to a purchase money security interest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Pirsch have left?
6 seconds.
Would you like your 6 seconds, or would you like to waive that?
I'll take them, Your Honor. Just all merely right. to note that at the time of the probate process, the plaintiff's counsel received a letter instructing them to file the claim within the time permitted by statute, according to the certified copy of the probate file.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Case is submitted and counsel is excused. Thank you.